On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Planning and Promoting Ecological Reuse of Remediated Sites. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's training. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the first few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors. As we go through the presentation today, each of you in the audience are in control of what slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors will say the slide number as we go through the slides today. If you're using the Cluent system, the series of orange buttons along the top allow you to navigate. The first button, the double left button, brings you back to slide one. The single left button brings you back one slide. Most often you'll be using that third button, the single right arrow, to move forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The double right fast forwards you to the last slide of the presentation. The house button takes you back to that presentation overview page where we started today. The question mark button is there primarily for a simulcast audience. Our simulcast audience is hearing the sound of today's training through their computer speakers. So if you're in the simulcast audience and you have a question or a comment, use that question mark button. That's going to allow you to type in a comment that I'll receive as a moderator, and we'll get to as many as we can during the question and answer breaks today. If you're in the phone line audience, you are welcome to ask your own questions out loud, but we do ask that you hold questions until the designated question and answer breaks. We're going to have one in about the middle of the class and another at the end. Today's training introduces the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance, Planning and Promoting Ecological Reuse of Remediated Sites. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we do encourage you to download the document itself. The presentation is also available to download. In addition to what you'll see on the slides during today's training event, we have more information in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded versions. And we'll take you to the links at the end of today's trainings where you can download the document and the training presentation. Today's training is brought to you in cooperation with the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. They host the Cluent website that we're using today. The design and construction of ecological end use as an integrated component of the remediation system will realize pronounced benefits. Today's training presents a process to promote ecological land reuse activities considering natural or green technologies instead of more traditional remedies. Ecological benefits and a process for calculating their value are included in the guidance and also reviewed in today's training class. If you move to slide two using that orange right arrow button, I'm going to talk very briefly about ITRC. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and it's a network that's led by state regulators. ITRC now includes all 50 states as well as D.C. Federal partners are Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. ITRC members also come from industry, and industry members participate through the Industry Affiliates Program. Members can also come from academia, as well as community stakeholders. For more information about ITRC, perhaps how you can become a member or the other tools that are available, please visit the ITRC website, and I've included that link at the top of today's slide. At the top of slide two. ITRC addresses a wide variety of topics, so you may want to go to the website to see what additional topics that ITRC has information on that you can use. We have products such as documents and training, like today's internet-based training. On slide three, this is our disclaimer and copyright, and we include this information in all ITRC training presentations. We ask that you please read over the slide. In short, it says we try to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide four, this is a list of training topics that we're going to address in 2008. You can see along the left is training classes that we're continuing to offer that we've developed in previous years. And then on the right, we're developing new classes every year, and this year has a large number of new classes that are going to come along. More information is available on ITRC website, and I've included that link again at the top of this slide. So if you're interested in one of these topics, you can go to the website, see the schedule for training classes. For the classes that we've already developed, there's maybe an archive of a training class that you can listen at any time. You would see the slides and also listen to a recording of a previous training class. On slide five, if you've joined after I've got started, please review the logistical reminders along the left. especially for our phone line audience. Reminder that we do ask you to keep your phone on mute during today's presentation so that we're not picking up background noise from your location. In today's presentation, we're going to start by talking about what are ecological enhancements and why end use is important. We're going to take a break for questions about halfway through, and we do ask that you hold all of your questions until the question and answer breaks. In the second half, we're going to talk about design elements, benefits, and economic considerations. At the end, we'll take you to some links to additional resources, and we'll also show you the feedback form. We do appreciate your feedback and hope that everyone on the line today takes time to fill out that feedback form for us. At the end, we'll have more time for questions. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. All instructors are members of the ITRC Ecological Reuse Team. Charles Johnson is a solid waste unit leader at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment in Denver. He has worked for the Hazardous Materials and Waste Management Division since 1991. He issues hazardous waste operating and post-closure permits, as well as oversees corrective action site inspections and characterization, remediation, and post-closure care projects. Charles is the team leader of the ITRC Ecological Reuse Team. Chuck Carmen is a senior associate ecologist with AMEC Earth and Environmental, located in Somerset, New Jersey. Since 2000, Chuck has worked for AMEC, specializing in natural resource-related assessment and management activities, including wetlands management and ecological restoration, ecological risk assessment, and natural resource damage assessments. Barb Padlow is a senior financial analyst located in Warrenville, Illinois, and works for the Finance and Risk Group in the remediation management function at BP. Prior to her role in risk and finance, she spent 9 years in the Environmental Technologies Development Group and 6 years at Amoco Oil Company's Process Design and Economics Group. If you move to slide 7, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Charles Johnson of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Charles?
Thank you very much, Juliana. As Juliana indicated, we should be on slide 7 now, starting out with the remainder of the instruction for this morning. And thank you for joining us to go over our internet training on the guidance document regarding planning and promoting ecological land use and remediated sites. What I'd like to talk about first is some of the major topics that we're going to go through and we'll address today. The first would be that this guidance is going to go towards identification of flexibility in the regulations as well as technologies and how to generate support for ecological land use at sites undergoing remediation, as well as how to integrate the concept of service capacity into the decision-making. And when we say decision-making, one thing you'll hear repeatedly from all three of us, myself, Chuck, and Barb today, is bringing the idea of these concepts of ecological land reuse to the forefront in the decision-making process and strategy, as well as evaluating it all the way through, as opposed to just attaching it as a secondary part of the process at the end. Certainly one of the things you'll hear from Chuck Harmon in the middle of our training today is that ecological land reuse is predicated on sound science and technology, and he'll go into that in some detail. We'll talk about how to refine and communicate the value of ecological land reuse, and Barb will get into that quite a bit in her section. We will identify strategies for enhancing and improving stakeholder involvement. And one of the things that should be appreciated here is a team working on this project, we're certainly advocates of this technology, and one of the things that we realized in developing our guidance is a need for robust stakeholder input. And we'll go into that a little bit more later in the training. And how to recognize that ecological reuse can deliver greater value than conventional remediation. And I think you'll see the ideas of remedial technologies brought forward by Chuck, as well as how to quantify and qualify those ideas by Barb. So let's go now to slide number 8, if we could please, and hit some of the key points. And this is part and parcel of a lot of ITRC's work, is that we will identify that, in fact, there are no regulatory barriers to using ecological.
Okay, hold on, let me get something to write with.
We've got some background there. Could y'all put your phone on mute, please? That, one, there are no regulatory barriers, and, in fact, the regulations actually tell us to go forward and to protect human health and the environment. We'll also get into the idea that Ecological land reuse, as we said, is based on sound science and technology and is not considered in lieu of protection of human health. And we'll elaborate on that a little bit longer later, as well as protection of the environment. We'll also talk about benefits and constraints, certainly with new and innovative or emerging technologies. There's upsides and downsides. We as a team, as I said, believe that there are very good reasons, and you will get a net benefit in using these technologies where appropriate at your sites, either for remediation elements or as long-term end use, and how to incorporate ecological enhancements proactively into remediation strategies. We'll also, like I said, Barb will get into her system of quantifying the value of ecological enhancements, and she'll discuss quantifiable parameters, semi-quantifiable parameters, and qualitative parameters. What each of those mean, as well as how to assign values to those and be able to help tell your story to promote using ecological land reuse as part of your remedial strategies. So now let's go to slide 9, and we're talking about ecological land use and a little bit of the definitions in the framework here, where ecological land use can be used for habitats and plants for animals while protecting human health and the environment. One of the things you may hear us as a team when we go through this is talk about ecological land reuse or ecological enhancements and land reuse interchangeably. As part of our partners on this team, when EPA was working with us early in this project, there was some resistance to using the term ecological enhancements because that had a specific connotation in some regulatory programs where if something was viewed as an ecological enhancement, that potentially some Superfund funding or other dollars might not be able to flow forward to support these projects. Certainly with EPA partnering through us, as well as other state and federal regulators, as well as consultants and industry owners and operators and stakeholders, we've come to appreciate that ecological enhancements should be thought of as part and parcel of land use strategies, and we'll clarify a little bit of that. And I think that's just a testament as to how far we've come in appreciating what an ecological enhancement may be and how it actually is an integral part of a remedial strategy. And we'll, like I said, elaborate on that a little bit more when we get to talking about site service capacity. And ecological enhancements can include natural or traditional remediation technologies. One of the things that was key to this team is understanding that really there's a need to do a true evaluation of site strategies for remedial approaches and what are the best choices you can make out there. And part of that may be using ecological or green technologies where appropriate, or in fact using conventional technology. And the fact that these can in fact be mixed with each other, and it doesn't have to be an all green technology based remediation strategy. It doesn't have to be all conventional. For example, as you can see in the photo on the upper right, where you have more conventional bank stabilization from a riprap project which backs up into a park, and what in this area, you're looking at a photo of Chattanooga, Tennessee, right on the other side of that bridge, that bank stabilization will wrap around into a reconstructed wetland with ecological enhancements that will in fact have part of the Trail of Tears as their Indian heritage in display over in that area, as well as a teaching environment to bring classrooms for education, study, and research into the wetland. So you're seeing a mix here of bank stabilization preventing erosion in a more traditional sense mixed on the other side of the bridge with this park setting into ecological enhancements. We've also seen evidence in some of the case studies where people had started with conventional technology, say a pump and treat, and then augmented that with phytotechnologies long term, so that in fact you can transition from conventional technologies into more ecologically based remediation strategies. And the end use, restoring or increasing ecological value of the land, is a significant part of these overall strategies where we're incorporating ecological enhancements into long-term ecological land reuse. And we'll chat about that some more here. Let's go now to slide 10, talk specifically about the technical and regulatory guidance. We already talked a little bit about the fact that we're going to get into benefits and limitations of using innovative technologies. We're also going to really get into recommendations for improvements to enhance acceptance of incorporating ecological elements into components of remedial strategies. That, again, goes back to the stakeholder support, I think, in a large way, and working with your community in long-range planning and bringing the stakeholders into the process as active participants, working with criteria in your remedial design and in your remedial strategy to see what they want to help foster and move these forward. We also want to talk a little bit about some case studies, and Barb will elaborate that as part of her discussion, as will Chuck. So another place where you can really get some very good information on case studies is part of going forward with this project. We were working with the Wildlife Habitat Council and other interested parties, and there was a white paper developed prior to this guidance. And as part of that white paper, it explained a little bit in framing the debate in how to use and where to use ecological enhancements as part of a remedial strategy. And to help support that, we wanted folks working on that white paper to bring case studies forward. And you can get the white paper off of the ITRC website that Juliana referred to, and we'll talk about again in the link section at the end of this training. But we developed a standardized format between 2 and 4 pages so folks could tell the stories of their specific case studies. And what it is it's a standardized format so you can kind of compare apples to apples when you read these. And it goes through where folks attempted to use ecological enhancements and how they benefited those projects, or in some cases where it may not have been necessarily the best solution. Because certainly, as Juliana indicated, as part of ITRC, one of our missions is to foster the successful implementation of innovative technologies. And going down that road, we certainly understand that these are innovative technologies, and in fact, you need to understand what technologies work best in different settings. And sometimes we learn from our mistakes. Most time we learn from our successes there. Let's go now to slide number 11. I want to talk a little bit about programmatic applicability. When we were first starting this project, we decided that certainly ecological enhancements going towards the idea of ecological end use is viable at a variety of active sites and settings, and certainly inactive sites and settings. And as a descriptor, that was fine, but people wanted more information as to actual programmatic applicability. Because when you get into active and inactive sites, you've pretty much bracketed the vast majority of everything that we deal with. But as you really peel the onion to look down into the middle of it, you can find out that using ecological remedial technologies to go towards ecological land uses are applicable at CERCLA sites, Department of Energy sites, Department of Defense sites. As a matter of fact, some of our most interesting discussions were with our DOD and DOE representatives because they have such large parcels of land. When you think of a military base and thousands of acres, or a mining district virtually under DOE, they have great opportunities to foster green technologies and bring that forward to help ensure long-term sustainability by using green technologies and driving towards ecological land reuse. RCRA Subtitle C, certainly applicable. I spent 15 years in hazardous waste corrective action before moving to solid waste, and these were part and parcel of a number of our remedies. Solid waste, absolutely, and I'll get to an illustrative example a little bit later on. Voluntary cleanup in brownfields, great ideas that we're having brought forward in the state of Colorado for old landfills that are being exhumed or re-stabilized and used with a combination approach from traditional geotechnical engineering as well as innovative green technologies to bring forward new shopping centers, new development areas, new places for people to put up multi-housing or multi-use housing where we have commercial on the first floor and we have lofts up above, mining sites, as we mentioned, underground storage tanks, and I think that one of our team members has a really neat example from years of experience with British Petroleum, where British Petroleum was in the forefront of remediating underground storage tank releases by planting different species and using phytotechnology. That evolved so much to the forefront that instead of waiting for a release to happen and then planting different vegetation for phytotechnology, that those species and the phytotechnology approach came forward as an integral part of landscaping in the initial design and construction of gas stations and underground storage tank sites. And certainly something that we don't necessarily as part of ITRC tackle directly as an element of being outside of a regulatory framework, but real estate transactions. And I think those are huge. While as regulators, we don't necessarily have a say in real estate and property development and redevelopment, we do have an integral role to play in not the real estate side, but the cleanup side that goes along with this as part of brownfields and voluntary cleanup operations, where we may not get involved in the real estate transaction itself, but what we do get involved in as regulators is how to promote good opportunities for remediation of sites and can encourage ecological technologies as part of the green approach and green strategies here. Let's go now to slide 12 and talk a little bit about applications where ecological reuse, and we've kind of been going back and forth, is it a green technology or is it an end use? And the answer is yes, it can be both. Because one of the things green technologies can do along the way is help restore habitat where it was lost in certain areas, and you can also create habitat where it wasn't before and still have great benefit and potentially get credit for that as part of your overall remediation strategy and working with regulatory agencies. And it's interesting in the fact that it can be both parts of this process, because I've used the word strategy several times by intent. When you're thinking of a strategy, it's not only how you're going to get something done, it's also what is long-term post-closure care or what kind of legacy can you leave behind with this. As part of our process to develop this guidance, we worked on a questionnaire that we sent to our ITRC states and members of our team. Interesting things that we learned when we started asking folks is, do you have guidance, or do you have regulation, or do you have policy, and do you have statutes? And we can rank those in legal format, even if you want, where statutes would be the highest, then regulations, then typically policy, and then guidance. And what we found was a true paucity in the fact that a lot of agencies did not have a whole lot of guidance, and they didn't have what they believe was a whole lot of policy on how to use green technologies and or whether or not ecological land reuse should be something that their agency is promoting and fostering. That's what they didn't have in writing. It's kind of interesting if we go to slide 14 and you really start talking to the agencies and they start answering other questions. While they may believe that they don't have statutes and regulations and policies and guidance, I think we as a team believe they actually do have regulations. We'll talk about that in just a second. But whether they have it in writing or not, one of the things that we found out in interviewing different agencies is that a lot of agencies, in fact, supported using green technologies, whether it would be a phytotechnology or an alternative landfill technology or as a cover system or a constructed wetland to help with the remediation process. They actually said not only did they support it, but when you look at the lower right-hand side on slide 14, you find out that agencies actually were designating it as part of records of decisions or corrective action plans or remedial projects. So here we are in a situation where we don't necessarily have a lot of guidance and we don't necessarily have a lot of information in writing, but we're actually out there as regulatory agencies fostering this and requiring this. And I'm actually going to beg to differ, and I think Chuck Harmon will support this in his portion, is there's certainly more and more guidance and information growing out there from the very time that we did this draft on this guidance document to today, that there's a lot more information in the universe that people are working with today than several years ago. So another question we asked, as portrayed on slide 15, is do you think you have regulatory authority to allow ecological land reuse? We did not get a lot of response formally in our survey in this, but we did some follow-up calling and talking to different agencies at state and federal and local levels, and it's interesting. From what we were seeing, the hazardous waste subtitle Seaside was not using very much, but where it was being brought forward and used the most is in brownfields and voluntary cleanup projects. So while we as agencies may not have had a lot in writing, somewhere along the line we were certainly partnering with owners and operators and consultants and communities on the voluntary cleanup. So while we seem to be a little bit lagging behind in documentation necessarily in the structured format, it was being brought to us, and we were embracing and approving that in the voluntary cleanup in the brownfield site. And a number of those, when you talk to different agencies, were showing up with mixed-use green technologies with conventional, and we'll talk about that too. Another thing I think was a little bit of a stigma is what people saw as barriers to implementing green technologies, ultimately ending up in ecological land reuse as a point of final departure from remediation into land reuse out there, where people believe there were not so many business practices prohibiting that. Some of that may have been liability management. Some of it may have been stigma from managers saying, with the impression that green technology certainly couldn't be as good or as productive or as economically competitive as conventional technologies. I think Barb Padlow will go right to the heart and soul of that discussion in her portion of the training. But in fact, people had a belief that, in fact, regulations prohibited or limited the use of green technologies with the goal of ending up in, with ecological land reuse. And that we're going to dispel here in just a second. But let's go to slide 17 right now and say, what was the goal for using ecological land reuse? And you can sort of see a split here between different communities on this slide 17, wherein the fact that certainly you can look at a lot of this as being interested parties providing information from the stakeholder and the community perspective versus the owner versus the regulators. Wildlife habitat was interesting when we were looking at what the goals of using ecological land reuse were as part of this whole pie diagram here. While ecological land reuse resulting in wildlife habitat was fairly large and fairly significant, I think we've seen a number of examples of that, directly opposing that on the pie chart, but of equal percentages, cost benefit. One of the things that using these technologies and remediation strategies gave a lot of businesses was some cost certainty and some cost benefit. Not only that, it was a situation where we believe right now, I think in industry as well as in regulators and most of the folks that we work with on these types of projects, as part of a remedial strategy, we can clean up surface water. We can and we know how to clean up groundwater. We can and we know how to clean up soil and sediment, different levels of effort. But one of the things we can do is look forward to, at the end of the day, when that property is going to go back into reuse or maybe even become part of a reuse project while it's being actively remediated, the fact is we can leave so much more behind besides just hardware and pumps and pipes and power sheds. We can leave trees and pocket parks and green belts. And one of the things that industry was telling us that it really helps them become a community partner. It helps with their marketing, with their visibility, and the idea of doing a remediation project with a little bit more innovation to it, a little bit more partnering with the community, can gain you so much more goodwill. And then you get the aesthetics and the recreation that the community was wanting as part of the long-term integral part of these projects, and you develop so much more partnership. Another thing popped out as we were going through research and writing our guidance and developing this training, as you can see on slide 18 now, is we developed some rules of thumb.
Ed Charles, this is Juliana. I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm going to go ahead and mute the lines. We are still picking up some background noise. So one moment, I'm going to mute all the lines. And Charles, if you select star 7, that's going to unmute just your line.
Juliana, can you hear me?
Yes, and I think that's going to help with the background noise, so we'll get a, you know, more pleasant to hear you speak.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, picking back up, we're on slide 18, ecological land reuse rules of thumb. There are times and places to use ecological land reuse, and there are times and places not. As I said, as a team, we are proponents of this, and we believe whether it's used at every site or not, it should be at least considered and evaluated. But sometimes if there's an immediate threat to human health in the environment, you may need to do something to contain off-site migration or direct communication from contaminants. For example, if you have a groundwater plume and it has vapors coming off and you have indoor air impacts, you may not have the time to fully develop ecological land reuse and green technologies to address that. You may need more immediately to put in a mitigation system. So we as a team certainly recognize that you need to address immediate threats. And whatever is going on with ecological land use and the use of green technologies is not used to compromise the protection of human health and the environment as cleanup goals. And that these technologies, green or combined, ending in ecological land reuse, can in fact be a net benefit to the region, and that they are more sustainable. And because they are more sustainable, if done well, then you can actually lower your post-closure care or your long-term care O&M liabilities there. And you lower those liabilities, but you also still have a sustainable project that's every bit, if not more effective than traditional technologies, because the sustainability is huge when you think of long-term uptime and operations. You're not looking at pumps going down. You're not looking at power going out. You actually have a system that has its own inherent sustainability. Another thing that was a rule of thumb is ecological land reuse should not create an additional connection to risk pathways. In other words, even if ecological land reuse might be the favorite technology, if in fact, for whatever reason, that methodology that's being proposed can create connection to an additional soil pathway, an additional groundwater pathway that's not acceptable, that either needs to be reconsidered in combination with conventional technologies or other ecological and green technologies being combined there so that you can actually break that pathway. Because certainly we don't want to enhance exposure to contaminants while we're in fact trying to remediate a site. So those are just some rule of thumbs that we came up with. Let's go now to slide 19. I want to talk a little bit about this flow chart here and what's a little bit different with this. And all this is really a simple flow through a project of developing a remedial strategy at a site. And it's interesting, a couple of years ago when we started this, this seemed a little more innovative than it does now, but we still want to go into this because as we talk with folks about developing these strategies, certainly there's a lot more to this, where you characterize the site, and then the next thing you do is look at local land use strategies. Instead of just characterizing the site, designing a remedy and implementing it, find out what the community wants. Evaluate remedial residual threats when you look at future land use. You can then use the ideas of the stakeholders to help support what that land use is going to be. You can tailor the remediation not only to eliminate the contaminants or stabilize the contaminants depending on the goal, but you actually know what the long-term use is going to be of that property. You understand how it's going to be stressed. You understand, is it going to have a parking lot on it, or is it going to have an alternative cover that's an open space? What are real potentials out here for exposure? And so you can actually use those pieces of information brought forward by the locals to help design the remedy, to help understand the stress, to help understand the failure modes. Once you understand the failure modes, then you actually can dovetail your post-closure care into that. And that's a huge benefit because what you're doing is really getting that input to carry you forward into a successful project. So let's go now into slide 20. Talk a little bit about the environmental benefits. I think most of these are recognized by practitioners in the arena, but we'll go through some. Certainly attracts wildlife, biodegrades contaminants, enhances natural attenuation. We've seen that, and there's a rich history of that. As a matter of fact, ITRC phytotechnology team has just updated their guidance on this issue. Can help control sediment and erosion, improves environmental stability while providing a harvestable resource, and certainly migratory bird pathways. Let's go to slide 21 now. Talk a little bit about some of the economic benefits. And we certainly realize, while these are broken into categories here, that environmental benefits versus economic benefits versus public benefits coming next flow back and forth. They don't necessarily pigeonhole, but we certainly wanted to show some categories here so you can appreciate the real benefits here, where you can enable more efficient use of limited resources, and you can generate true value as a harvestable resource that we talked about last time. Barb will certainly get in, as we mentioned already, into the cost-competitive nature of green technologies headed towards ecological land reuse long-term, and there's a potential for tax advantages. Let's go now to slide 22, and I think some of this was recognized when we looked at the pie chart. Educational opportunities, I talked about that with Chattanooga, where they're going to have teaching opportunities along with their constructed wetlands. Goodwill and being a good neighbor. Increased reputation is absolutely critical with a lot of the companies in their communities as they brought that forward. Is they want a good image, and a great way to have a good image is to involve community input, like we talked about just a second ago, so that when you're done with a remediation, you leave a positive legacy behind, aesthetics and increased natural resources also being seen. Let's go to slide 23 now. And certainly with anything innovative, while there's an upside, there's also things you should be cognizant of. So that while they're not fatal flaws, you want to apply extra creativity and ingenuity in overcoming some of what some people may see as constraints. I think there's three of them here that really come together. Regulatory acceptance and lack of familiarity, as well as the fact that you are going to develop a site-specific unique solution, which is going to require more creativity. And actually, even there's a fourth one that jumps in here, that sometimes the habitat creation can require more complex analysis of the setting. But one of the things that we're really growing in here is our knowledge and our comfort with the fact, while we don't have as many years of experience using green technologies headed towards ecological land reuse as some of our conventional technologies, it's a great opportunity to get out of the box, listen to what the community's talking to you about, what they want to see as long-term reuse out here, and to move forward where you get more data, a little more data, you become a little more creative, and you actually, in fact, come up with better solutions. So while those are actually constraints, certainly there are things that I think, as we learn more about this, are turning into positives and assets for us. And certainly you may also have the ideas of a little bit different vegetation in an area, which can lead to some different allergies. Again, those are all things that can be addressed as part of the design and implementation of the strategy. On slide 24, as I said, this is a regulatory-based issue, and I don't mean to put this slide up here to have you read this at length. Certainly you can go back to the archive, or if you've downloaded it, you have it here. But what we're looking at is at the hazardous waste regulations at the federal level on closure of Subtitle C facilities, where it says that a regional administrator, and in most situations where you have an authorized state, the division director or deputy commissioners, or however you're structured, can approve or replace all or part of the closure requirements with alternative requirements, so long as the alternative requirements will satisfy the closure performance standard. And the narrative closure performance standard goes to protection of human health and the environment. So key here is one of the things that we seem to do a whole lot better in the early years when I was in hazardous waste is, yeah, we could protect human health, but we weren't as good at protecting the environment. I would argue that we are bound by regulation to protect not only human health, by the environment. By protecting the environment, you do need to restore those things that are lost or improve things under site surface capacity concepts that take you forward to the next level. On slide 25, a little bit more, when we dug into the regulations, certainly there's hazardous waste flexibility. We also saw similar flexibility in solid waste brownfields and CERCLA, as well as mining regulations and other entities. So one of the things we found is the myth, actually, of regulatory barriers, I think, is fairly easy to debunk. In fact, we're actually required to sustain the environment out there. Let's go to slide 26, talk briefly about site service capacity, and this is where we get into the idea of what was there, what was lost, and how to bring it back. And this is where EPA really started working with us and helping us to understand the broader scale of some of these activities, where we had site properties and they were used for different situations, have contaminants on it, and we've lost capacity out of that. Then if you look at how you're going to remediate that site, where EPA really stepped forward with us, as well as some of the practitioners in the art of ecological land reuse, said, yeah, but if you have a lot of other development going on in an area and you have a site that you're remediated, because of development in one area, the region may have lost wetlands and you may have an opportunity to bring a wetland back, for example, on a site that didn't have one originally as part of your protective measures there. Now what we have is something new that could at one time have been seen as an ecological enhancement because it did not exist in that site. But what you're redoing is replenishing a regional resource on a discrete property, and that imbalance is a benefit to the whole region. And so, as we said, being proponents of this technology and using green technologies towards an ecological land reuse, certainly we want to be considerate that that's not the only use in all situations, But also, when you look at site service capacity and site restoration, don't look just at that one discrete element, because if you look more locally or more regionally, you may find more opportunities to replenish something that was there and was once lost through just general development and growth and sprawl. And that can lead you towards more green technologies and can lead you towards the opportunity for ecological land reuse. So on slide 27, talk a little bit about integrating elements of ecological land reuse into the beginning of the process. We talked about this a little bit on our flowchart. One of the things that seems to have happened historically, and is key and very significant here, is the fact that we used to do a whole remediation project and protect human health, and that was good. And then we'd come on afterwards to the site, and we'd redesign and re-stakeholder the process and remobilize and reconstruct and re-engineer all this stuff for the ecological land reuse aspect. What we would like to do is change that mold. We would like to change that mold so much so that what you're doing is thinking about the land reuse because of stakeholder input up front, and that you design ecological land reuse incorporating green technologies up front again, and that we go through one construction phase that optimizes the scale of economies of a single design process, a single mobilization, a single construction, leading towards a common long-term care goal out there. On slide 28 now, we can go to natural remediation technologies. ITRC, as it says on this page, you can go to their website. They have a variety of technologies that you can come together, which are green technologies leading towards ecological land reuse. And if we go to slide 29, and I'll let y'all go to some of those guidances to pull down. The idea on 29 is here are some green technologies. Again, we're blending these together. What were traditional technologies now can have alternative technologies and ecological elements when you look at the last column there on the right, all going towards what you can see on slide 30 is the mixed end use. And I'll give you my favorite example. Let's take the old landfill that used to be sort of out in the middle of nowhere, because it was far enough to not be seen in anybody's backyard, but cheap enough to haul to, and it ultimately is going to get closed. And we have options on how we close this. And what I would like to think of using green technologies going towards an ecological land reuse is the fact that we would close that landfill, possibly using an alternative landfill cover where we create a green space or a park, or maybe a green space and a park and soccer fields or baseball fields or an alternate use there, and that we would create a passive drain for the leachate system. Again, another green technology, green remediation here, and that passive drain goes to the wetland system, and now what we have is a different habitat that we've created in an area, possibly offsetting some that was previously displaced by sprawl, and you end up now where you have an alternative cover with multivariant use going into another technology, being the pond that creates habitat for recreation and for education and research, and you've got all of this coming together where you can in fact have an old landfill that's closed in a positive manner that enhances its value to the community, so the communities are proponents of this project, and you move forward with a very positive net benefit towards the end. And now we can go to slide 31, back to Juliana for questions and answers.
Thank you, Charles. We now are going to take a break for questions. If you're in our simulcast audience, it's that orange question mark at the top of the screen that's going to allow you to send in a question. For our phone line participants, we encourage you to ask your own questions out loud. When you state your question, say your name and location, and you're welcome to refer to a slide number if you'd like to. For our phone participants, you're going to need to unmute your phone. In addition to unmuting using your phone, you also need to select *7 to unmute the line, because we've muted all lines. So it's *7 to unmute your phone. Would someone in the phone line like to start with a question? A simulcast question from Will Gala at Chevron in California. Why shouldn't gains in ecological benefits associated with ecological enhancements offset ecological risk as long as the net environmental benefit is positive?
I think they may actually do exactly that, especially if you're looking truly at the NEPA process or the net environmental benefit. If you're doing net environmental benefit or other methodologies, as Barbara's going to talk about a little bit later, In fact, you may have gains that do offset that. Now, I'm not sure if we're talking about only the ecological gains or if we're also talking about monetary gains, but if you're talking about, or if you're getting into natural resource damage issues, if you're getting into that, that's something you need to take up with your specific regulators working on their site. But, and we did not specifically delve into that. We started to, and as a team, we think that that probably desires a much more thorough discussion than we could give as just a single section in this guidance. So to go back towards that, one, on the remediation as well as on the outcome, we believe that, in fact, these technologies will offset there, and they have that capability. So far as being cost competitive, I think Chuck will touch on that a little bit, and Barb will certainly go into the details of that. We think it actually is cost competitive and can offset that. If you're looking at the NERDS issues, that's something that's really a little bit beyond the scope of this guidance. So,
thank you. For our phone line audience, a reminder, it is *7 to unmute if you'd like to ask a question. It does take a few minutes for the simulcast questions to come through, so I'm going to wait another minute or two to see if we do get more questions through our simulcast audience. And again, for the simulcast, it's the orange question mark at the top of the screen that will allow you to send in a question. We will have more time at the end for questions, so if you do end up having a question that we haven't been able to get to yet during today's or this first question and answer break, we will address that in the next question and answer break. I have a question from Bill Hagel at US EPA Region 3 in Philadelphia. Does the guidance address the use, monitoring, and enforcement of institutional controls to maintain the ecological use and value over the long term, and or to maintain the protectiveness of the remedy?
Can you say that one more time, Juliana? I missed the first part of the question.
No problem. Does the guidance address the use, monitoring, and enforcement of institutional controls to maintain the ecological use and value over the long term, and or to maintain the protectiveness of the remedy?
This guidance actually doesn't go into different types of mechanisms, but there is a parallel guidance that that ITRC has developed on monitoring, evaluating, and ending post-closure care. And that's really guided at landfills, but there's a model that's presented in there that I think is very good on how to evaluate the effectiveness of a remedy. Now, it's predicated on a landfill, but it can certainly have the concepts tailored to a variety of other remedial approaches. And what that does is it goes through the idea of when is a, in this case, closure period ending, but for this guidance, we could think of a remediation project ending, and where it presents no further risk or threat to human health and the environment, as the regs say, and going out of regulatory post-closure care into custodial care. So what I would suggest is that the person who's asking this question or anybody else with similar questions, take a look at that post-closure care guidance document, and when you look at that, don't think of it just as a landfill, but think of taking the concepts in there and the decision points and data needs and extrapolating that to a hazardous waste site or a brownfield site or a cleanup site, or, as they're asking here, the effectiveness of a remediation under maybe corrective action or another program.
Thank you. This is Juliana, and I'll also add that the ITRC Brownfields team is working on a document on institutional controls that's due at the end of this year. So check back for more information on that document. A person in the simulcast asked who is speaking, and this is Charles Johnson of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, who is our speaker in the first half of the training class. Before we wrap up this question and answer break, do we have any questions from our phone line audience?
If I can ask one follow-up question to the gentleman from Chevron's question.
Yes.
I would be curious. curious as to the opinion as to if you're looking at an enhancement to offset ecological risk, how you address the potential attractive nuisance issues for one, and two, how does that approach go to, at least from a CERCLA perspective, the requirement to be protective of the environment? In other words, if you are offsetting risk by creating an enhancement, you still haven't addressed the risk. So I don't see how those two are necessarily, how you can use an enhancement to offset a risk from a purely protectiveness standpoint.
Chuck, do you want to start on that one, or do you want me to jump on that?
And Chuck, it is *7 to unmute your line.
Oh, do you hear me?
We do now, thank you.
Okay, I thought I'd done that. Regarding the protectiveness issue, particularly at hazardous waste sites such as Superfund, the ecological enhancement is my experience, is more than likely not going to be handled in such a way that it's going to be used as compensation for an exceedance of excessive risk. From an ecological standpoint, you're going to end up having to use your ecological risk in coordination with your other investigative activities as part of, you know, assessing what are the appropriate cleanup levels that are going to be required for your particular location. And when you start moving into the remedial activities necessary to, you know, design some approach to addressing those remedial risks, the concept of, you know, where to employ an ecological enhancement will then start coming into play. Now, the whole concept of net environmental benefit analysis, and I'll touch on this a little bit, you know, is something that, again, this is from my personal experience with it. You know, there's a lot of discussion with the regulatory agencies, both at various federal and state levels, you know, as to its appropriateness, and I've certainly seen it examined in terms of whether a particular remedial action is going to do more harm than it is actually going to do good from an ecological function standpoint. But I haven't seen it used a lot, and in some instances, it actually has served to increase the level of post-remedial monitoring that is required to ensure that, you know, if something is actually that important that you would want to go through the NEPA process, then maybe we need to really, really monitor this function to make sure that it's handled appropriately. Charles?
I think that buttons it quite well, actually.
I mean, ecological risk is probably going to be used in terms of ensuring that, or could be used, and there's an OSWER directive that actually outlines this, that the ecological risk process can be used to ensure that, you know, your remedial action in itself does not impact ecological resources. You know, the question of nuisance species is something that I've seen being a little bit more from a societal issue as opposed to truly having a relationship to, you know, what you're trying to create at a given site. But that's kind of my opinions on it.
So in other words, you have to address the ecological risk before you know, addressing the ecological risk is separate from the enhancements.
Correct.
Okay.
It's not my experience that you're going to employ an ecological enhancement, and certainly the regulations don't lead you down that path where you would try to employ an ecological enhancement as a means of reducing your cleanup, you know, from an ecological standpoint.
Okay, thank you for your opinion on that. Appreciate
it. You're welcome.
Thank you to our instructors for and our question people asking questions during today's question and answer break. We're going to go ahead and wrap up this first question and answer break. We'll have more time for questions at the end of the training class. And if you have taken your phone off of mute, it is *6 to put back on mute. On slide 32, I'll turn today's presentation over to Chuck Harmon at AMEC Earth and Environmental. Chuck?
Thank you, Juliana. The beginning of my presentation here is going to walk right into some of those discussions that we just had relative to ecological risk versus ecological enhancements. But suffice to say, and this is something that Charles had actually indicated earlier, the whole concept of using ecological enhancements is something that is becoming more and more an important part of addressing environmental liabilities at a site, whether it be from the concept of just purely from a remediation standpoint or even in the NERDA approach. But I have a number of sites on the East Coast where I mostly work where we are looking at ecological enhancement that is creating some advantageous increase in ecological function of some component of the environment as part of an NRD settlement or remediation where we're doing activities that will increase the value ecologically of a piece of property or a site or some waterway or something like that. For example, we have a site that I'm working at, large 900-acre piece of property. There is a inactive landfill that's been appropriately capped at one portion of the site. There's another site where, adjacent to it, where additional capping activities will be needed as part of the addressing of NRD issues for that particular location. One of the things that we're trying to look at is to actually expand do the capping, and then instead of using a typical, engineered landfill cap that you would see, use something that provides more ecological value, such as the planting of short prairie grasses and low shrubs and such, and actually change the vegetation on top of the existing cap, so that now instead of an existing cap that requires a normal amount of maintenance, you're going to have increased the amount of true grassland area that doesn't need as much maintenance, thereby saving you money, but provides a tremendous increase in the value to upland water birds and other type bird life that requires some fairly large areas of land in terms of the habitat, that's required for them to live on. So that's just, there are a number of instances that I can point to, but this is a concept that more and more is becoming very prevalent in today's managing of hazardous waste sites and other type activities. But basically, as we talk about on slide 32, the whole conceptual approach here is the fact that we do have something, we have a stress site. There's something that's been released into the environment, or something that has occurred there. It could even be a physical manifestation, but something where we have lost an ecological resource, we've damaged the function of that resource, and so there has to be some activity which addresses that stress. And if working under various regulations, CERCLA, RCRA, other state regulations, there's some requirement to resolve human impacts or potential threats to human health in the environment through an action. And quite often, and this is particularly in the NRD arena, that remedial action doesn't necessarily restore the impacted resource to its ecological or pre-existing condition. So you have to have some sort of ecological enhancement that could be coupled in with the remedial activity to increase the value of the resource, adding a whole variety of benefits, again, as Charles pointed out, from a public perception, an ecological, or an economic standpoint. And so basically the ecological enhancement is initiated to restore the impacted resource to its pre-existing condition and or increase the ecological value of other resources on site as a means of improving the ecological service capacity of the site as a whole. If you'd move to slide number 33, again, this is this slide actually was generated in response to questions which have already come up today, and that is, you know, what's the difference between an ecological risk assessment and ecological restoration or the implementation of ecological end use? Well, ecological risk assessment is it's an iterative process, generally incorporated in the investigative stages of your site assessment, but basically its intention is to try to determine what is the potential for adverse ecological impacts to occur at your site, and then help with the engineers in terms of determining, you know, what is the appropriate ecological cleanup goal that can be appropriately utilized there at your site. Whereas the restoration process figures in at a later stage of the overall site system, and in that instance, what we're looking at is trying to restore whatever the previous ecosystem was, and that can include, you know, things such as reestablishing ecological function, natural communities which may have been at that site prior to whatever release or activity resulted in the loss of function. Okay, moving to slide number 34. You know, I'm not going to get into this except to say that this is the decision tree that outlines the steps that one would look at in terms of trying to address and trying to resolve, you know, and implement the use of ecological enhancements at a site. It's thoroughly discussed in the guidance document, so I would refer you to that. Again, I'm just putting it up here for illustrative standpoint. Again, looking at the document would provide all the information you need to know. So moving to slide number 35, what are these ecological enhancements? What are these activities that we're looking at from a hypothetical standpoint? They can include, you know, in an upland environment, you know, things such as restoring or enhancing forests and shrubs or grassland meadows. If you have some activity such as an excavation project or a capping, you know, you have the ability to, depending on the surface capacity of your site, to target and implement, you know, some sort of restoration of these communities. Some of the determining factor, you know, as to what type of community or what type of ecosystem might you look at, is, you know, probably the most obvious would be, you know, what are the surrounding systems? You know, what were the circumstances of the site, you know, prior to the, you know, to the release or to the intrusive activity, to the stress? What are the functions that you would like out of the desired systems? And then one of the very common things that quite often people tend to forget, and that is, you know, what are the local climate conditions? You know, if you have a site that you're looking at implementing an ecological enhancement based on, you know, the restoration of a forest or a shrubland, and you're locating your site out in the middle of out in the Midwest area dominated by grasslands, primarily due to a shortage of rainfall, you're probably not going to be too successful in terms of, you know, getting that system back in. So it's something that you always have to consider, and I'll talk a little bit more about some of the technical aspects of ecological restoration in just a minute, but you have to incorporate or have to understand, you know, what are the aerial climatic conditions before you can actually put something back together. Moving to slide number 36, there's a possibility that if you have a restoration at a site where you are trying to clean up, dredge contaminated sediment, or do some other type of activity, where you may have the opportunity to target and enhance a freshwater ecosystem. This would include things like something in a stream or a pond or a lake. And a lot of times these are implemented by using very simple, structures that don't require a lot of maintenance, but provide a tremendous amount of habitat. Boulders and weirs, fish passages, rock shelters. I've seen these and have used these, in a river up in the New England area where, you simply, put a rock weir out into the water. It deflects, increases currents, changes, after the remediation and excavation of a contaminated sediments, you put one of these structures in, creates, changes in currents, modifies the bottom topography, starts developing, pooled areas and, run areas through a fairly, homogeneous habitat, and changing that habitat to something that's much more heterogeneous, which then creates all sorts of habitat opportunities for a greater diversity of fish. So these are activities that don't require a tremendous level of cost, but they can provide a tremendous level of ecological benefit by simply considering and incorporating them as you move through the process. If you move to slide number 37, there also could be an opportunity that, as part of your site, you're looking at some sort of wetland ecological enhancement. One study has noted that as much as 74% of all surplus sites in regions 1, 2, 3, and 4 combined are associated in some form or fashion with wetlands. So you may end up having to look at, some sort of ecological end use which incorporates wetlands or the creation or the restoration of wetlands into your mix. Now, one of the things to keep in mind is that, with wetlands, you have other regulatory obligations under the Clean Water Act or under state wetland statutes that may require you to do this as opposed to just doing something that makes sense to the environment. The ITRC did publish a guidance document back in 2005, which has a large amount of information in it regarding characterization, design, and construction of mitigation wetlands. And you can go to the ITRC website to download that particular document. And finally, as you move to slide number 38, you can even move, we've gone from, very upland conditions all the way now down to the coast, but there may be instances where you actually have to look at shoreline activities in terms of needing ecological end-use implementation or ecological restoration. Okay, moving to slide number 39. Okay, so we've talked a little bit so far about, the various types of ecosystems that you could potentially use, whether it be a wetlands or an upland forest or a shoreline. So how do you choose one? Okay, and so the next slides we'll talk a little bit about some of the conceptual thoughts that you would go through, the process you might implement to decide how you're going to change or implement your site to address ecological end uses. Well, part of that process is going to be based on the ecological needs or services that have been lost both on a site basis as well as a regional basis. There's a lot of impetus now, particularly in the wetlands environment, for responsible parties that are looking at doing wetlands restoration and such to consider not only, the type of wetlands that you, looked at or lost at your site, but also what is the prevalence of wetlands that have been lost on a regional basis. So if you lost, say, a emergent wetland at your site and that's what you're going to plan initially on restoring, however, if you look on a regional basis and see that, even though you lost emergent wetlands at your site, there's still a plethora of emergent wetlands throughout the region. However, there's been a tremendous loss in forested wetlands. So, you know, the possibility is, well, maybe we will consider that as our targeted end use, is to create a forested wetlands as a means of trying to complement that regional need that we've identified. Another need for a means of choosing an ecological end use is going to depend on, you know, what is your actual end use targets? You know, what are you looking at? Also, what kind of a remedial approach are you going to need to addressing on-site contamination? And then, finally, are there regulatory requirements for some form of mitigation? Okay, moving to slide number 40 now. As Charles mentioned, the whole concept of surface capacity feeds right into determining what are the needs for your particular site in terms of trying to decide what your ecological end use is. And that surface capacity is based on the site's ability to offer societal values based on both the property and its relationship to the surrounding region. Now, as an ecologist, I'm really focused on ecological service capacity, so I want to know what that site's value is to ecological users, and so my ecological end use is going to end up being some sort of habitat for fish or wildlife usage. If you'd move to slide 41, again, this has been mentioned once a couple of times by Charles, and I want to go ahead and reiterate it. The primary goal of, you know, your action at the site is to mitigate threats to human health and the environment, and it's going to be determined, that goal, by the physical actions that are needed to meet some established cleanup goal, whether it's a goal that's based on ecological risk or a goal that's based on a human health risk. And it's not necessarily the objective of an ecological enhancement to remove that particular cleanup requirement. However, you know, the surface capacity issue can be impacted by, you know, what type of contamination and how the remedy is going to be implemented. And this is where the net environmental benefit analysis, where you're basically, again, looking at, you know, what is the role of the remedy in terms of, you know, is the cure, as I like to say, is the cure worse than the disease? Is your implemented remedy going to cause greater ecological harm than the actual process of just allowing the contamination to remain? So not that that's going to take you out of doing the remediation, but it may help you to focus in terms of selecting an ecological end use or just actually deciding, you know, how your remedy is going to be implemented. And one of the things that really, you know, ends up being is that something that has to be scaled to meet not only the needs of the property owner, but as well as the regulatory agencies and quite often the community stakeholders which may be associated with it. Okay, if we'd move to slide number 42, there are some factors from a hypothetical standpoint that are going to help you decide what kind of ecological end use that you're going to use and choose the choice process. That first, you know, factor that may come into play is the size of your site. The larger your site, the greater the likelihood of supporting a very viable self-sustaining ecosystem. So, you know, if I have a site that is an acre or two in size, and I am, you know, looking at, you know, implementing some sort of ecological end use there, well, you know, instead of looking at, you know, throwing in, you know, big restoration projects for grasslands or forests, you may look at just installing something to, you know, increase, you know, habitat usage at that site. And it could be, you know, something as simple as the installation of bird boxes or changing your mowing patterns, you know, in some portions of the site. Existing habitat at the site, another factor in determining the choice of an end use. The less disturbance of existing habitat, the better. And a corollary to that would be its proximity to existing undisturbed areas. It's real easy to implement an ecological restoration project, you know, if you have some connection to a, you know, larger, pre-existing undisturbed area. If you are, you know, trying to implement an ecological in-use at your site, and your area is, surrounded by 200 years worth of development, it's probably not likely that, you're going to choose, some major restoration of the habitat because it's probably not going to be functional. On the other hand, if you have a site that has, even a connection to some undisturbed habitat, that's going to change the type of habitat you may end up choosing and what kind of approach you may take in terms of that particular ecological in-use. Moving on to slide number 43, again, still looking at what kind of factors for determining a choice of in-use. The surrounding land uses, what type of area, that actually surrounds the area and allows you to implement your ecological in-use. What is the topography of the area? If you have something that has a great deal of elevational changes, that's going to modify what kind of in-use you may end up choosing. And hydrology. That if your in-use is water dependent, you have to have water on site. If it's a wetlands mitigation or restoration project, then hydrology is going to be the major determining factor as to whether your project is a success and something to consider. Okay, moving to slide number 44. Now, I've mentioned this a little bit, or at least alluded to it, but we'll spend just a second talking about it. And how do we use ecological end uses? Where do they fit into the process? Well, in some instances, your ecological end use can, be incorporated using some sort of green technology. Or you can incorporate the ecological end use as part of a traditional remedial technology. Or you might be able to, incorporate the ecological end use as the remedial technology. And we'll talk about each one of those three briefly in the coming slides. So moving to slide number 45, designing an ecological end use using green technologies. This is where we would use something like phytoremediation, or some other type green method for treating a waste site or something which would require possibly using plants to draw water to extract toxics or even to assist in the microbial digestion of those toxics. We do have, again, ITRC has a number of guidance documents related to things like this, including phytoremediation. So again, I would refer you to those particular documents to really gain a detailed understanding of those particular approaches. Slide number 46, we can also incorporate the design of an ecological land reuse using or incorporating it as part of traditional remedial technologies. You can incorporate it to compensate for impacts to the environment at the point of remediation. Say you excavate, cap, or even install a groundwater pump and treat system that may require you or allow you the opportunity to incorporate an ecological end use after you have, completed your particular activity. And some of the issues to be considered doing that could include things like, increasing biodiversity or what type of scope you have at the end of the end-use project. But the goal here is to initiate the project site along some sort of developmental pathway that will lead ultimately to a self-sustaining ecosystem. Now, when we do this, there's some things that we want to keep in from a hypothetical standpoint. We want to keep into consideration, and I have to apologize. I'm starting to run a little short on time, so I'm going to kind of speed up the pace of going through some of this material. But in terms of what type of biodiversity or the diversity of ecological organisms, biological organisms that you have at the site, You want to use small patches of natural communities to help sustain regional diversity. Again, there's that, you know, looking at the broad range of things at your site. Understand that buffer zones between natural communities are very important, and that full restoration of a native plant community will sustain a very diverse wildlife population, and that the more complex the habitat, the greater the number of wildlife species. Also understand that a high diversity of plant species ensures a year-round food supply, and that species survival depends on maintaining a minimum population level. So you have to have that vegetative community that has been successful to be able to have a diverse wildlife community supported by it. And that generally low-intensity land management will sustain a lot more species and certainly cost a lot less than something that requires a high-intensity development. Okay, moving to slide number 48, now, what we're going to start talking now a little bit about is that we're decided to incorporate an ecological end use into my site plan, my site operations. I've decided what it's going to be. I have an idea as to, you know, what kind of target end use it's going to be. I have some idea of what kind of function I would like it to have. So how do I go about actually getting this particular event into the ground? You know, what do I need to do? So the planning for these type of activities includes, as shown on slide number 48, includes a, you know, a multidisciplinary team. I am an ecologist. I can tell you what all sorts of plants and animals you know, need to go into a particular area, or what I would like to go into a particular area. However, you know, those type of general desires don't necessarily equate to the guys that drive the push the yellow iron. So I need to have the involvement of engineers and people who are going to sign and seal plans that you can give to a construction person and says that this is how you do your particular activity. You know, likewise, you might need the involvement of wildlife biologists, you might need the involvement of geologists, hydrogeologists. It all depends on what you're building at your site. It's just the understanding is that it will take a number of people involved to be able to create some of these things. One of the critical, features of, planning is to define your goals. You have to state right up front what am I trying to do and how am I going to do it. Some of the other phases that go into planning are understanding what the ecological characteristics of your site are, developing site plan, identifying, selecting plants, then actually putting the thing in ground, and once you have it there, you know, conducting long-term monitoring and maintenance to make sure that it's a success. Now, how do we describe success? You know, there are a variety of means that you can do this. You know, you're basically looking at trying to get some assemblage of species based on, you know, maybe a pre-disturbance understanding of the ecology or the structure of a community you would like to target. But generally, you do want to use native plant species, and you ultimately certainly want to have it in such a manner that you're defining it as a system that functions normally and allows for a reproductive success in the population that's there. Okay, moving to slide number 50. As I mentioned, goals and objectives, one of the critical features of your particular project, you have to state, you know, what am I trying to do? So your goals are going to be, you know, the conditions required to be achieved by the project, and then the objectives could be a variety of attributes such as the, you know, the number and composition of plant species, structure or function, or maybe some sort of aesthetic feature that you're looking at. Moving to slide number 51, now before you can actually go out into the area and start designing, you have to have an understanding of a variety of different components. You know, what kind of plants are there, what kind of animals, you know, what's the hydrology and soils. You know, those are all things that you need to understand so that you can design an ecological end use, you know, based on what are the, the pre-disturbance features, what's the post-disturbance features, and what am I trying to reach in terms of goals or objectives for my site. Okay, moving to slide number 52, you're going to incorporate all that information in something, again, that you're going to give to the excavators and constructors, by way of a site plan. It's going to have plans and specifications required for putting your project in place, including things such as schedules and budgets, and, this is where you at least put in your expected performance requirements for your project. Slide number 53, the consideration, again, one of the facets of this, is that if you build it, they will come. As I mentioned earlier in some of the principles, you need to have a strong functioning, vegetative community that will bring in a wide diversity of wildlife. And so how do you get there? That includes, understanding, what kind of plants are you going to put in, where are you going to plant them, what the size is, when are you going to plant them, what are the benefits of the species, are you putting a plant that's going to flower a lot and offer a lot of advantageous, butterflies or hummingbirds, or is it fruiting plants that will feed birds or small mammals, or they are other types of trees that are going to provide browse for deer or other species such as this. You need to understand that, as well as how are you going to plant them, what kind of mulch, what kind of fertilizer or supplemental watering you're going to use to get these things again in the ground. Once you've made all those decisions, you actually then would go through and put it in the ground. Do whatever is necessary to prepare your site, ensuring that you have some, appropriate soil erosion and sediment control procedures in place, and then plant things and make sure that you have them down. Moving to slide number 55, one of the things that, you do have to consider is the presence, and I can certainly attest from doing a lot of this kind of work on the East Coast, issues related to invasive and undesirable species are, they're very difficult. Purple loosestrife, Phragmites, Japanese knotweed, Japanese stilt grass, the list just goes on and on for, the number of, invasive species that have been brought into the U.S., which can displace native species and change totally the appearance and functionality of your end-use project. And so you have to know how to manage them. So you have to consider that such that, they don't take over your community and start driving it to some end. There are a couple of websites that we have listed here that will allow you to check on, what are the primary species you need to be concerned with in your area, and some ideas on how to use them, how to control them, I should say, through either manual or herbicidal controls. And then finally, the last thing is that while setting your goals and objectives is probably the most important thing that you're going to do in your project, probably the second most important is going to be monitoring and maintenance. There have to be procedures for setting up, steps to ensure that your project gets in place. You have to have performance standards that will allow you to measure whether your project is successful, and you have to go through the process of ensuring that those things, are met. That may you may end up actually having to implement corrective measures such as fencing or replanting. Could be predator control. I've put in extensive tracts of woody vegetation, trees, where we've had to go back and surround each one of those trees with a wire cage to keep the beaver from coming in and taking them all down. So those are some of the things that you might have to do up to and including, and you certainly don't want to go there, but something such as the redesign or reconstruction of your particular site. So with that, I believe that takes me to the last part of this training exercise. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Barb Padlow.
Thank you, Chuck. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. I'm going to be starting on slide 57. As Juliana mentioned earlier with my little bio, I have a background where I have been in environmental technology in an industry setting. And part of the problem with developing, you know, some of these ecological enhancements and end uses was convincing other people that they were a good thing to utilize at their sites. Partly some preconceived notions about what was allowed and not allowed, as Charles alluded to earlier, notions that it would be more expensive, or notions that they just didn't know how to compare it to other traditional projects that we, you know, have become accustomed to using. So one of the, you know, things we decided to do when we were developing the guidance was to talk about a practical system for evaluating ecological enhancements or land reuses. And if we can turn to slide 58, one of the methods was alluded to earlier was NEBA, or Net Environmental Benefits Analysis. And this is a system that currently exists, and it will look at the effects on ecological and human use environmental service values. It'll weigh the negatives and positives and predict changes in risk scenarios and costs for one environmental option compared to another. So NEBA will systematically compare and rank ecological alternatives. It'll decide which one achieves the greatest net environmental benefit at the lowest cost while maintaining protection of human health and the environment. And this is a very effective tool for doing so, but the problem we have is that it doesn't allow you to compare ecological enhancements to traditional capital expense projects. So we had to come up with a new method to do just that. Turning to slide 59, Charles mentioned earlier, you know, we recognize there are economic benefits with ecological enhancements. They can be cost competitive, provide opportunities to obtain environmental offsets, provide use for waste materials and more efficient use of limited resources. They can, in some instances, generate revenue, such as seed banks. They can provide marketing or competitive advantage, sources of recoverable resources, and in some cases can offer tax advantages. These different items can be fairly easy to quantify, and they shouldn't be ignored. They should certainly be involved in a decision to use an ecological enhancement. Turning to slide 60, we've also got a number of public benefits. Local conservation groups could be supportive of projects using ecological land reuse. That support can be helpful in moving projects along, can save costs. These projects can create educational opportunities to work with scouting groups or other wildlife groups. They can improve a community image, provide seed beds and breeding grounds for non-government organizations and other nonprofits, and they can certainly help our public relations and corporate reputation. Now, some of these benefits are a lot more difficult and in some cases impossible to quantify, but we don't want to ignore them when we're making a decision about whether or not to use an ecological enhancement. So turning to slide 61, earlier in the presentation, Charles mentioned that we had asked, you know, in our survey, what was the goal for using ecological land reuse as part of a remedial or corrective action project. One of the top responses was cost benefit. People recognize that there is a benefit to using ecological enhancements. It's just sometimes tough to wrap your hands around what those benefits actually are. So what we've come up with is a three-pronged process to look at an ecological alternative and evaluate it for use at a site. This three-pronged approach includes quantifiable values, those things that are easy to put some numbers around, semi-quantifiable values. These are more items that we know they're going to have an impact on our costs, we're just not sure how. And then finally, qualitative values, things that we're really not going to be able to put a number to, but we want to make sure that we tell it as part of the story when we're convincing our decision maker which alternative they should be using. Turning to slide 62, this is a visual representation of the three-pronged process. What we have in the upper left are your quantifiable values influencing your value of an ecological reuse. These quantifiable values could include project design and development costs, capital costs, operations and maintenance costs, and environmental liability. We might be able to reverse provisions that are on the books, which would certainly sway you maybe for or against ecological enhancement. to the upper right, we have those semi-quantifiable values, which could include stakeholder issues, regulatory agency issues, and ecological issues. You know, what are risks to species that currently exist out there? Could we get wildlife accreditation? Some different things to consider that it's not easy to put a number on, but again, we know that they're going to impact our costs. And finally, those qualitative values, including things like livability, strategic planning, corporate values, in some cases, license to operate in the area. Again, these are things that could influence the decision maker, and we want to make sure that we roll them into our analysis. Now, the best way to really understand how to use all three of these factors in an analysis is to look at an example. So if we turn to slide 63, we've created a little refinery example here built somewhat on reality. I do want to point out that there are additional examples in the guidance document. We're only going to show one here with the training, but please refer to the guidance document for others. So for our refinery example, we have a 2-acre open area on an outer perimeter around the refinery that's covered with grass. We have total petroleum hydrocarbon impacts about 3 to 7 feet below ground surface. Currently, we are not actively doing remediation in this property. We are just spending about $5,000 per year for maintenance of the grass area. However, we do recognize that eventually we're going to have to do something out here, and we've estimated that in about 10 years we're going to have to do some kind of a small remediation project at about $50,000. Now, the ecological enhancement that has been proposed for this site is to revegetate the area using native deep-rooted prairie species. The costs that have been estimated for this alternative are $20,000 for plant screening tests. We want to make sure we're putting the proper species out there. $15,000 for the initial planting, $5,000 per year for the first 3 years has been allocated for replanting species that might not make it through the winter, $5,000 per year for site maintenance as well. Now, the upside to this proposal is that we could potentially avoid the $50,000 remediation because of the increased bioremediation from the deep-rooted species. So let's turn to slide 64 and start with the first prong of our three-prong approach, looking at our quantifiable values. What our ecological enhancements team has done is to pull together a list of things that you should consider each time you are evaluating an ecological enhancement. Eventually, you would get to the point that you would kind of skip through this list quickly and find the items that apply or don't apply. But the point of the list is to make sure that you're consistently evaluating the project and you always think of these different potential cost items and don't forget something to bring it to the table. So what we've got here so far for our list, and you could add to it certainly as you use it over time, project design and development costs. We want to make sure it meets remedial goals. Do we have an option for alternative endpoints? Is there cost recovery options? Does it affect our risk or site assessments? How about permitting and contracting costs, security costs, attractive nuisance costs? Under the capital costs, we want to make sure that we're not only, you know, talking about the, you know, the installation, but technology development costs and potential external funding, operation maintenance costs, the monitoring, reporting, tax payments, project length, and then certainly under environmental liabilities, what are the future use liabilities and supplemental environmental projects that might be done, and what are the long-term cost liabilities? So if we turn to slide 65, what we can see is that we've looked through this list to see how it applies to our refinery example. What we've got under remedial goals is certainly all alternatives must be protective of human health and the environment. If our ecological enhancement did not satisfy those goals, we would simply not be able to use it. In this case, we're good to go. Alternative endpoints. Our proposal will stimulate bioremediation and potentially avoid $50,000 remediation in 10 years. Under security, this land is ultimately for reuse of the surrounding community. We don't really see a need for additional security costs. Attractive nuisance, we pretty much figure that's been rolled into part of the monitoring cost. Capital costs under technology development, we have that $20,000. Under monitoring, we have $10,000 per year for the first 3 years and $5,000 a year for the remaining 7 years. Future use liabilities, we have none. This is going to be a recreational area. And long-term cost liabilities, we're going to avoid that remediation in 10 years. So let's turn to slide 66 and see how we now roll those quantifiables into our refinery sample. Our base case, which was to leave the grass area as it is, we had that $5,000 per year maintenance, $50,000 of remediation out in year 10. You can just, you know, go into Excel and do a simple discounted cash flow analysis using their net present value calculator. I used a 9% discount rate for this example, just kind of plugged this all into Excel. And Excel came back and said that my net present cost is actually $71,000 for the base case. So the leave the grass area as it is, it's going to cost us $71,000 over that 10-year period. For the ecological enhancement, you can see the list of costs there. Again, plugging this into our Excel spreadsheet with a 9% discount rate resulted in a net present cost of $83,000. So the difference between the two of these is $12,000. And essentially we're saying that's an additional $12,000 over 10 years to do the ecological enhancement. Now that doesn't seem like a lot of money, but if you are in a cash-constrained environment, you simply would not choose the ecological enhancement. You would stay with your base case. So now we're going to talk about moving into some of those semi-quantifiable values that could influence our costs. If we move on to slide 67, we again have developed a list of semi-quantifiable values that we want you to evaluate each time you're looking at using an ecological enhancement. Stakeholder issues, we have the community engagement, social mores, NGO engagement, regional needs and compatibility, educational and recreational opportunities, avoiding property condemnation, and corporate shareholder value. Regulatory, is this an innovative approach? Is there a chance for reimbursement? How does it affect our relationship with the agency? And are we setting precedents with this work? Under ecological, do we have any benefits for biodiversity or erosion control or stormwater management? And do we have conservation or mitigation concerns or greenhouse gas effect concerns? Again, all of these are the kind of things that are difficult to quantify, but we know that they have an impact on our choice. So if we turn to slide 68, we can see how these semi-quantifiable values apply to our refinery example. Under the stakeholders, we have scouts involved from the community perspective. They want to go out there and label plants and trees and have some of their hikes out there. Social mores, the residents are happy. They're kind of tired of looking at just an empty field. They would like to see something a little more pleasing to the eye. NGO engagement, could we get WIC certification at this site? And the region has identified a need for some more recreational area. Under regulatory, this is innovative in the sense that we're trying to remediate before we really have to. We would certainly increase biodiversity and increase erosion control. So these are a number of, you know, values to our approach with the ecological enhancement that we want to make sure you consider. There is a lot of literature data that exists that would suggest that almost 5 to 200% of the cost for a remediation project are for these, quote, non-remediation expenses. Local meetings, reporting, working through the project to make sure everyone's happy. A lot of different costs that are not just simply putting in a system and cleaning up the site. So what we've done, if you will turn to slide 69, is develop a chart that talks about how you can roll these semi-quantifiable values into your calculation. And what we've done is broken up the impact into three categories: low impact, moderate impact, and high impact. And we have a multiplier that we've associated with each of those impact categories. Those multipliers, you know, we can see there 5 to 20%, 20 to 50%, and 50 to 200%. For our particular refinery example, we've said that we think the impact of those semi-quantifiable values is low, but it's getting up there a little bit. So our gut feel was that this was going to be on the higher end of the low category. So we assigned a multiplier of 15%. Now, I recognize this is a bit of a judgment call. You have to use your experience, your gut feel, to determine what that number could be. But when you're doing an economic analysis, you know, you can always do a sensitivity analysis on the back end and change that number to as low as 5 to as high as, you know, whatever you want it to be, and talk with your decision maker about why you think it should be that value, why they think there should be that value, and then talk about the results based on those two endpoints. Well, let's turn to slide 70 and again see how those semi-quantifiables affect our refinery example. What you see there on the base case is I've increased the maintenance cost there by 15% because it actually represents the opportunity lost for not going with the ecological enhancement. So my cost would increase on that base case by that 15%. You could argue that perhaps the remediation in 10 years would also increase by that amount, but for simplicity, we just left it on the maintenance cost for now. And running this through Excel with your 9% discount, again, we have a new net present cost of $77,000. So this increased $6,000 from our previous estimate. For our ecological enhancement, the net present cost was $83,000, which was the same. Nothing's changed there. What we have now is the difference, the incremental change, is only $6,000 additional over 10 years to go with the ecological enhancement. So basically, you're talking about $600 a year over this 10-year period to do this ecological enhancement. You know, if you're still looking and you say, I'm still cash constrained, I'm still going to go with the one that's simply cheaper, you're still behind the eight ball. So what I suggest is you then turn to slide 71, and let's talk about that final prong in our approach, the qualitative values. Again, we've developed a list of different things you should consider each time you evaluate an ecological enhancement. We have livability issues, aesthetics, noise, odor, visibility, the health and security of the area, the community character, sense of place, corporate values, core values and policies, company pride, your moral responsibilities, cultural alignment and enhanced reputation and employee morale, strategic planning, public and government relations, your license to operate in the area, and sustainable legacy. Turning to slide 72, again, we look at that list for our refinery example. And, you know, we see a number of areas where we're going to see an increase, a benefit by going with the ecological enhancement over the base case. We're going to improve the aesthetics. We're going to do a little bit more of what the community wants and enhance their sense of community character. It's going to, you know, fall in line with our company core values and policies, which is going to make us feel better about who we work for. It's going to enhance our reputation as a company. It's going to enhance our employee morale, which is always going to have a direct impact on your productivity. And we stand the chance to increase our public and government relations as well. So turning to slide 73, again looking at our refinery example, what we've now said is it's, you know, a negative $6,000 net present value. So it's basically an additional $6,000 of cost over 10 years to go with our ecological enhancement. But you have to balance that against the qualitative benefits we just identified on that last slide. And you also have to balance that against the risks, the sensitivities to your analysis. What's the risk that the future remediation of the base case is going to stay at $50,000? If it actually was $60,000, our delta net present value, that difference, would be zero. And they would essentially be equal footing for an economic evaluation. So these are things that, you know, we want to consider all of the points and wrap them all into our analysis. And if you turn to slide 74, a picture is always worth a thousand words. This is what our site looks like currently. We have kind of some scrubby grass area in here. You can see the houses off in the background there. And if you turn to slide 75, this is what our site could potentially look like if we implemented our ecological enhancement. Definitely something much more attractive, and as you can imagine, scouts on their hikes at meetings, going out there and checking the place out, it just makes people feel better about what you're doing. So if we can turn to slide 76, I'm going to wrap up my story. You need to consider all of the elements so that projects can be evaluated consistently and completely. Run through those lists. Eventually you get experienced enough that you can quickly knock off the ones that don't apply to your case. But we don't want to forget anything, so it's good to keep looking at those lists. Establish a financial estimate for all the elements and move as many as possible to the estimable category. Things that can be quantified are always easier to present, so the more we can move over into that category, the better. Once you've evaluated the different types of values that you have, the quantitative, the semi-quantitative, and the qualitative, conduct a net present value analysis using Excel. Very simple. There's a lot of different materials out there to help you walk through that. include those semi-quantifiables as a simple multiplier in your analysis, and make sure you don't forget to include those qualitatives as part of your story. And I think that wraps up what I have, and I can turn this back now to Charles.
Thanks, Barb. Appreciate that. Let's go to slide 77 now for a wrap-up and just kind of an overview of the whole of the training from the introduction through Chuck's design and consideration side and Barb's economic and ecological evaluation process. There is, as a team, and hopefully we bore this out today, and it's certainly brought out in the guidance that there are no regulatory barriers to using green technologies or ecological endpoints, and that they should, that ecological remediation technologies and ecological endpoints are the real deal. As we said earlier, there's science and technology behind this. It's not a bait and switch. It's not in lieu of something else to protect human health and the environment. And then if you're going to employ green technologies and ecological endpoints, they should be considered proactively incorporated into the remedial strategy, not just something thrown on at the end. And that, as Chuck really went on, I think elaborated nicely on how to use site service capacity to do a more considered evaluation of the needs of the area, maybe not just an individual site, but what the needs are. And certainly EPA has bought into that process now. And that one of the key elements of this, to bringing these considerations forward in the design and strategy development process, is getting meaningful stakeholder involvement early. Let them help you make some of these input parameters come to focus in your design strategy so you can understand what some of their goals are and you can dovetail a safe, protective remediation with long-term use and a more positive legacy. And as Barb certainly went into, is the three prongs of her approach to quantitative, semi-quantitative, and qualitative aspects that pull your information together, do your analysis, and tell the whole story. I think that's certainly one thing as a team we appreciate and believe very much. So thank you, Barb, and thank you, Chuck, for helping with this training. And Juliana, I'd like to turn it back over to you now.
Thank you, Charles. On slide 78, before we get to our next break for questions and answers, I'd like to take you to our links to additional resources. So if you select that area of the slide, that's going to take you over to the links page. The reason we've listed this URL is that it's going to continue to be available as a resource for you, so you can come back to this site if, you know, in the future. From the links page, the first item that I'm going to point out is, if you look to the left, is the feedback form. So the third item down links you over to the feedback form. And we do appreciate your taking a few minutes today to fill out that feedback. Let us know what you thought of the training class. We do look over that information, and we use that as we improve our ITRC training events. Looking back to the right in the links to additional resources, the first link, download today's ITRC training, that's going to allow you to download the presentation that we've used during today's class. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, more material is available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded versions. The next link is the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guide, Planning and Promoting Ecological Land Reuse of Remediated Sites, the ECO-2 document. If you select that corresponding blue button, that's going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF of the document that is the basis for today's training class. Also available is the first document from the ITRC Ecological Reuse Team, making the case for ecological enhancements. We also list other ITRC documents. We've talked about some of these during today's training class. In Section 2 are more resources for you, documents and websites that you may find useful. Section 3 is social science related to ecology, and then Section 4 and 5 is going to take you to the ITRC website and to the CLUIN website. We do now want to get to questions from our audience. For our phone line audience, you need to unmute the phone, not only using your phone, but also using our system. It is star 7 to unmute. And just state your name and location when asking a question. For our simulcast participants, it's back over to the slides and the question mark button that's going to allow you to send in a question. Related to the simulcast questions, we do have one from Bill Hagel at USEPA in Philadelphia. And, Bill, only part of your question came through. So if you could go ahead and type that question in again, and or perhaps it got answered, you know, during the rest of the training. So if you do have another question, please, Bill, send that in again. Do we have questions from our phone line audience to start? I have a question from Clark Reen at Hydrogeologic in Kansas, and he's working on sites where they have a timeline of 10 years, And this has discouraged the use of ecological remediations, and they're using traditional remedies because of the time frame limitations. Do you have any suggestions for convincing regulatory agencies to either move away from regulatory time frames, ways to accelerate the ecological remedies to meet regulatory requirements, or ways to provide strong evidence that the ecological remedies can meet the time frames?
Chuck, do you want to start with some of the design and share some of your thoughts, and I'll jump in with some other regulatory perspective?
Yeah, I was considering that as I went through, trying to convince a regulatory agency to move off of requirements for, you know, certain time limitations can be very difficult, and, you know, I've been in that position. The problem with, you know, the use of an ecological enhancement as the remedial activity is that sometimes and this is something that we saw in the constructed wetlands team, which I would encourage you to go to that ITRC document if you want some additional information on the topic. But you would see changes in improvements in environmental quality using ecological based remedial activities, but they didn't necessarily move at the pace at which you might see something, you know, which is more traditional, which is, you know, can be, you know, of much, you know, greater rapidity with which, you know, you see the impacts, the effects. So if that's the case, then you end up having to, and you're not able to dissuade the agencies from moving off of a regulatory time frame, again, is to use the ecological enhancement in conjunction with the traditional remedy, you know, either at the site following remedial implementation, or maybe, you know, at a different part of the site in conjunction with that remedial implementation. Charles?
Yeah, from the regulatory perspective, one of the things that we typically do is evaluate the immediate threat. And I think we touched on that a little bit kind of in our rules of thumb. And I think Chuck really hit a nail on the head is how do you measure success? For example, even if let's take the example of a groundwater plume potentially going off site. And even if you put in a pump and treat system, those typically have a startup period and some of the ones I've worked on that are 3/4 of a mile to a mile long, whether it's active pump and treat or funneling gate or any variety of those, let's say pump and treat, you have a period of time to achieve drawdown and coalesce overlapping plumes for true containment. And for some, those may be 6-8 months to truly reach more of a static equilibrium in your containment and capture contaminants. And I'll stick with the groundwater issue because the other methodology that a lot of folks have grown to use over the years is natural attenuation. Well, natural attenuation comes with a source control. So here comes the concept of what is the real threat and what's truly recognized in sitting down with your regulators. If you do a more conventional source control or maybe even a ecologically based source control, how much time is used and negotiated with your regulator then to stabilize the plume as well as to abate or remediate the plume. So from my perspective, sitting in the chair, question is, if you do a combination of techniques, there's a lot of opportunity for discussion there. Or if your regulators are willing to sit and listen with you, as we've done in the past in Colorado some, is please tell us what the real threat is, who's actually being exposed now, and while we may do monitoring to evaluate exposure, how long will it take for the green technology and ecological enhancements to take hold and start managing the plume? Part of that is the balancing between actual threat and potential threat. Like I said, if you have a groundwater plume under a house and an indoor air issue, that's pretty immediate. But we as regulators, the folks that I've worked with over the years, do that balancing act. And while it is hard, and one of the things I've told folks, we will take a managed risk with you, but we may ask for additional monitoring And so our trade is we may get more frequent monitoring or different types of monitoring to ensure that the threat is not becoming direct, but in fact that the ecological enhancement has some time to mature and to take hold. So certainly it's a negotiated process, and I can understand the concern, but I think there are some legitimate positions to present on true long-term benefit with no net actual negative impact while you're working on remedial efforts.
Thank you. Do we have a question from our phone line audience? And remember, it is *7 to unmute. A simulcast question from Dana DeWeese at DNR in Jefferson City, Missouri. In this world of increasing demand on world food and construction resources, especially as we see damaging trends in China, Latin America, and other developing nations who routinely damage pristine lands to produce or obtain agricultural and forest resources, it seems reasonable to propose that a portion of our reclaimed land be utilized for production or sustainable agriculture or production forest product purposes. In your experience, do you see a trend or any trend in that direction here in the U.S.?
I'll start that. I don't think I have a very quantitative answer. Certainly Barb and Chuck may have more details, but we work a lot in solid waste with sustainable energy in Colorado, and we dovetail actually directly with our governor's office on this stuff. And one of the questions that's come up that I've started asking people, if you do ecological enhancements, are those also greenhouse gas mitigation and carbon credit issues? And we haven't really matured that discussion very much, quite candidly, but I think it's one that's legitimate. Chuck, Barb?
Well, from my standpoint, the process is, you know, of ecological enhancements has not really been utilized to the point where you look at sustainable development of natural resources, that is agriculture or forestry components. The idea is to utilize these approaches at enhancing or developing natural habitats to support a diverse community with a variety of wildlife species is not something that is necessarily intended to move over into changes in agricultural practices or being able to modify the way in which forestry practices are implemented. That doesn't mean that it couldn't go that direction, and I can certainly see some means of where that would be the case, but a lot of the base information that has come out of CERCLA and some of the other, EPA and other organizations on this particular process is really focused more on the development of natural communities.
I'm going to chime in a little bit. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to put on my cynical hat a little bit. So much of what's driven is driven by economics. You know, when it becomes economically, painful for people, they'll start diverting money into these kinds of arenas, developing more land for sustainability. And the trick is to point out now that it's economically painful. And people will only look at, how much it costs me today to take this land out of an agricultural, or put it into an agricultural, use instead of building a condo building. And they'll look simply at what they benefit from the condo building, which will, far outweigh the economics of the crops you'll get out of that land, just looking at the numbers. You really need to talk about some of these other, difficult to quantify or qualitative issues and roll it into your argument. And we need to start considering some of these long-term things, and we need to start rolling them into these analyses to convince people that it does make economic sense to do this now. It's hard, but, it's very a logical approach, and it's something you can, explain to somebody and convince them that this is something we have to do for our long-term economic sustainability. and, you know, this is my cynical part, money talks. You know, we all know that, you know, it's great to do an ecological enhancement, but if it costs a lot more money, most people will shy away from it. We really want to look at those costs. We want to start having those conversations and talking to people about the long-term repercussions. You know, I remember having a Wildlife Habitat Council meeting in New Orleans a couple of years ago. It was May, shortly before Katrina had hit. And we had a presentation from the Army Corps of Engineers, and they talked about the fact that losing all those low-lying marshlands on the coast was really making it very dangerous that New Orleans itself could be flooded. And I sat there and I thought, wow, has anyone done an economic analysis of this? And now having the hindsight to say how much it costs to have that huge impact on the city and on the people and on our country as a whole, boy, could you have justified beefing up, you know, some of the protective barriers we had out there? I bet you could have. But we need to do that kind of long-term analysis, put it into the dollars that these people see and can understand easily so that they will be more persuaded to go down that path. Okay, I'll take my cynical hat off now.
Thank you, Barb. Do you have any questions from our phone line audience?
This is Bruce Pluta, EPA Region 3. Just a follow-up comment to the latter conversation. There are some instances in Region 3, specifically a DOD site, where they have taken a landfill and they have proposed to use warm season grasses. While it will provide some ecological benefit, which they're doing elsewhere on their installation, they're converting the one site specifically for switchgrass for biofuels processing on site. There are also there's more and more work being done looking at ecological enhancements, ecological restoration, and those components for carbon sequestration on sites. So that element's being developed more and more.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and wrap up today's training call. I'd like to thank both our instructors and our participants for joining us today. If you have not already, please fill out the feedback form. We do use that information and appreciate your taking just a few minutes to give us feedback. For more information about ITRC, you can visit the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again, and have a great day.